He turned his head and bowed in the direction of the man in the chair.
Your Holiness, the cause of death of the 67,000-some men, women, and children found on the HHMS Saigon Meru was not consistent with the wounds discovered on Mars's victims, or consistent with prior tales of Shrike attack. Cardinal Lord Usami took a rustling step forward.
And, according to your Holy Office forensic experts, Cardinal Mustafa, what was the cause of death for the human beings found aboard this freighter?
Cardinal Mustafa's eyes were lowered as he spoke.
Your Excellency, neither the Holy Office nor the Pax Fleet forensic specialists could specify any cause of death for these people. In fact, Mustafa stopped.
In fact, Lord Usami continued for him, the bodies found aboard the Saigon Meru, exclusive of the crew, showed neither clear cause of death nor the attributes of death. Is that not correct?
That is correct, Your Excellency.
Mustafa's eyes roamed to the faces of the other dignitaries in the chapel.
They were not living, but they showed no signs of decomposition, post-mortem lividity, brain decay, none of the usual signs of physical death.
Yet they were not alive?
Prompted Lord Usami.
Cardinal Mustafa rubbed his cheek.
Not within our capacity to revive, Your Excellency. Nor within our ability to detect signs of brain or cellular activity. They were stopped.
And what was the disposition of the bulk freighter, HHMS Saigon Meru, Cardinal Mustafa?
Captain Walmack put a prize crew aboard from the Jibril, said the Grand Inquisitor.
We returned immediately to Pachem to report the matter. The Saigon Meru was traveling via traditional Hawking Drive, escorted by 4 Hawking Drive torch ships, and is scheduled to arrive in the nearest Pax system with the Pax fleet base, Barnard system, I believe, in, 3 standard weeks.
Lord Usami nodded slowly.
Thank you, Grand Inquisitor.
The Secretary of State walked to a place near the Pope's chair, genuflected toward the altar and crossed himself as he crossed the aisle.
Your Holiness, I would ask that we hear from Her Excellency, Cardinal Dunoyer.
Pope Urban raised one hand as if in benediction.
We would be pleased to listen to Cardinal Dunoyer.
Kenzo Isozaki's mind was reeling. Why were they being told these things? What possible purpose could it serve for the CEOs of the Pax Mercantilis to hear these things? Isozaki's blood had chilled at the summary death sentence of Admiral Aldecacti. Was that to be the fate of all of them? No, he realized. Aldecacti had received a sentence of excommunication and execution for simple incompetence. If Mustafa, Peli Konyani, himself and the others were to be charged with some variety of treason, quick, simple execution would be the furthest thing from their fates. The pain machines in Castel Sant'Angelo would be humming and grating for centuries. Cardinal Dunoyer obviously had chosen to be resurrected as an old woman. As with most older people, she looked in perfect health. All of her teeth, wrinkles at a minimum, dark eyes clear and bright. But she also preferred to be seen with her white hair, cut almost to the scalp, and skin tight across her sharp cheekbones. She began without preliminaries.
Your Holiness, Excellencies, other worthies, I appear here today as Prefect and President of Cor Unum and de facto spokesperson for the private agency known as Opus Dei. For reasons which shall become apparent, the administrators of Opus Dei could not and should not be present here this day.
Continue, Your Excellency, said Cardinal Lord Usami.
The bulk freighter, the HHMS Saigon Meru, was purchased by Cor Unum for Opus Dei, diverted from scrap recycling, and delivered to that agency 7 years ago.
For what purpose, Your Excellency?
Queried Lord Usami.
Cardinal Dunoyer's gaze moved from face to face in the small chapel, ending at His Holiness and looking down in respect.
for the purpose of transporting the lifeless bodies of millions of people, such as were found on this interrupted voyage, Excellencies, Your Holiness. The four mercantilist CEOs made a noise, somewhere short of a gasp, but louder than a mere intake of breath.
"Lifeless bodies," repeated Cardinal Lourdesami,
but with the calm tone of a prosecuting attorney who knows in advance what the answers to all questions will be.
"Lifeless bodies from where, Cardinal Dunoyer?"
"From whatever world Opus Dei designates, Your Excellency," said Dunoyer. "In the past 5 years, these worlds have included Hebron, Cumriad, Fuji, Nevermore, Sol Draconi Septim, Parvati, Tsingtao Siswang Pana, New Mecca, Mao IV, Ixion, the Lambert Ring Territories, Sibiatu's Bitterness, Mare Infinitus North Littoral, Renaissance Miner's Terraformed Moon, New Harmony, New Earth, and Mars." All non-Pax worlds, thought Kenzo Isozaki, or worlds where the Pax has only a foothold.
"And how many bodies have these Opus Dei and Cor Unum freighters transported, Cardinal Dunoyer?"
Lord Usami asked in his low rumble.
"Approximately 7 billion, Your Excellency," said the old woman.
Kenzo Isozaki concentrated on keeping his balance. 7 billion bodies. A bulk freighter like the Saigon Maru could haul perhaps 100,000 corpses if they were stacked like cordwood. It would take the Saigon Maru some 70,000 trips to haul 7 billion people from star system to star system. Absurd. Unless there were scores of bulk freighters, many of them the newer Nova class, on hundreds or thousands of shuttle trips. Each of the worlds that Dunoyer had mentioned had been closed to the Pax Mercantilis for all or some of the past 4 years, quarantined because of trade or diplomatic disputes with the Pax.
"These are all non-Christian worlds," Isozaki realized that he had spoken aloud.
It was the greatest breach of discipline he had ever suffered. The men and women in the chapel turned their heads in his direction.
"All non-Christian worlds," Isozaki said again, omitting even the honorifics in addressing the others. "Or Christian worlds with large populations of non-Christians, such as Mars or Fuji or Nevermore. Cor Unum and Opus Dei have been exterminating non-Christians. But why transport their bodies? Why not just leave them to rot on their home worlds and then bring in the Pax colonists?"
His Holiness held up one hand. Isozaki fell silent. The Pope nodded in the direction of Cardinal Lourdesami.
"Cardinal Dunoyer,"
said the Secretary of State, as if Isozaki had not spoken.
"What is the destination of these freighters?"
"I do not know, Your Excellency."
Lourdesami nodded.
"And who authorized this project, Cardinal Dunoyer?"
"The Peace and Justice Commission, Your Excellency."
Isozaki's head snapped around. The Cardinal had just laid the blame for this atrocity, this unprecedented mass murder, directly at the feet of one man. The Peace and Justice Commission had one prefect and only one prefect. Pope Urban XVI, formerly Pope Julius XIV. Isozaki lowered his gaze to the shoes of the fisherman and contemplated rushing the fiend, attempting to get his fingers around the Pope's scrawny throat. He knew that the silent guards in the corner would cut him down halfway there. He was still tempted to try.
"And do you know, Cardinal Dunoyer," continued Lord Usami,
as if nothing terrible had been revealed, nothing unspeakable had been spoken,
"how these people, these non-Christians, are rendered lifeless?"
"Rendered lifeless," thought Isozaki, who had always hated euphemisms.
"Murdered, you motherfucker."
"No," said Cardinal Dunoyer. "My job as prefect of Cor Unum is merely to provide Opus Dei with the transport necessary to carry out their duties. The destinations of the ships and what happened before my freighters are needed is not, has never been, my concern."
Isozaki went to one knee on the stone floor, not to pray, but just because he could no longer stand.
"How many centuries, gods of my ancestors, have accomplices to mass murder answered in this way? Since Horace Glennon Height, since the legendary Hitler, since forever."
Thank you, Cardinal Dunoye, said Lord Usami.
The old woman stepped back. Incredibly, it was the Pope who was rising, moving forward, his white slippers making soft sounds on the stone. His Holiness walked between the staring people, past Cardinal Mustafa and Father Farrell, past Cardinal Lord Usami and Monsignor Odi, past Cardinal Dunoye and the unnamed Monsignor behind her, past the empty pillows where the Pax Fleet officers had been, past CEO Aaron and CEO Haim Odino and CEO Anna Pella Cognani, to where Isozaki knelt, close to vomiting, black dots dancing in his vision. His Holiness laid a hand on the head of the man who was even at that moment contemplating killing him.
"Rise, our son," said the mass murderer of billions. "Stand and listen. We command you."
Isozaki rose, legs apart, teetering. His arms and hands tingled, as if someone had zapped him with a neural stunner. But he knew it was his own body betraying him. He could not have closed his fingers around anyone's throat at that moment. It was difficult enough just to stand alone. Pope Urban XVI extended a hand, set it on the CEO's shoulder, and steadied him.
"Listen, brother in Christ. Listen."
His Holiness turned his head and dipped his mitre forward. Counselor Albedo stepped to the edge of the low dais and began to speak.
"Your Holiness, Your Excellencies, Honorable Chief Executive Officers," said the man in gray. Albedo's voice was as smooth as his hair, as smooth as his gray gaze, as smooth as the silk of his gray cape. Kenzo Isozaki trembled at the sound of it. He remembered the agony and embarrassment of the moment when Albedo had turned the CEO's cruciform into a crucible of pain.
"Tell us who you are, please," rumbled Lord Usami in his most congenial tone.
"Personal advisor to His Holiness Pope Urban XVI, Kenzo Isozaki was prepared to hear. Albedo's gray presence had been glimpsed and rumored for decades and decades. He was never identified other than personal advisor to His Holiness.
"I am an artificial construct, a cybrid, created by elements of the AI Technocore," said Counselor Albedo. "I am here as a representative of those elements of the Corps."
Everyone in the room, except for His Holiness and Cardinal Lord Usami, took a step away from Albedo. No one spoke, no one gasped or cried out. But the animal scent of terror and revulsion in the little chapel could not have been stronger if the shrike had suddenly materialized among them. Kenzo Isozaki felt the Pope's fingers still tight on his shoulder. He wondered if His Holiness could feel the pounding of his pulse through flesh and bone.
"The human beings transported from the worlds listed by Cardinal Dunoye were rendered lifeless by core technology, using core robot spacecraft, and are being stored using core techniques," continued Albedo. "As Cardinal Dunoye reported, approximately 7 billion non-Christians have been processed in this manner over the past 7 years. Another 40 to 50 billion must be similarly processed in the next standard decade. It is time to explain the reason for this project and to enlist your direct aid in it."
Kenzo Isozaki was thinking. It is possible to wire the human skeletal structure with a powerful protein-based explosive so subtle that even the Swiss Guard sniffers would not have detected it. Would to the gods I had done that before coming here.
The Pope released Isozaki's shoulder and walked softly to the dais, touching the sleeve of Counselor Albedo's robe as he passed. His Holiness sat in his straight-backed chair. His thin face was peaceful.
"We wish you all to listen carefully," said His Holiness. "Counselor Albedo speaks with our authorization and approval. Continue, please."
Albedo bowed his head slightly and turned back toward the staring dignitaries. Even the Pope's security guards had moved back to the wall.
"You have been told, largely through myth and legend, but also through church history," began Albedo, that the Technocore was destroyed in the fall of the Farcasters. That is not true. You have been told, primarily through the banned Hyperion Cantos, that the core consisted of three elements. The Stables, who wished to preserve the status quo between humanity and the core. The Volatiles, who viewed humanity as a threat and plotted to destroy it, primarily through the destruction of the Earth via the big mistake of 08. And the Ultimates, who thought only of creating an AI-based ultimate intelligence, a sort of silicon god which could predict and rule over the universe, or at least this galaxy. All these truths are lies.
Isozaki realized that Anna Pelakonyani had gripped his wrist with her cool fingers and was squeezing very hard.
The Technocore was never grouped into three warring elements, said Albedo, pacing in front of the altar and dais. From its evolution into consciousness 1,000 years ago, the core was made up of thousands of distinct elements and factions, often warring, more often cooperating, but always struggling to achieve a synthesis of agreement toward the direction autonomous intelligence and artificial life should evolve. That agreement has never crystallized. Almost at the same time that the Technocore was evolving into true autonomy, while most of humankind lived on the surface of and in near orbit around one world, Old Earth, humanity had developed the capacity to change its own genetic programming, that is, to determine its own evolution. This breakthrough came partially through developments in the early 21st century AD in genetic manipulation, but was made possible most directly through the refinement of advanced nanotechnology, at first under the direction and control of early core AIs working in conjunction with human researchers. Nanotech life forms, autonomous beings, some intelligent, much smaller than a cell, some molecular in size, soon developed their own raison d'etre and raison d'état. Nanomachines, many in the form of viruses, invaded and reshaped humanity like a terrible viral plague. Luckily for both the human race and the race of autonomous intelligences now known as the core, the primary vector for that plague was in the early seed ships and other slower-than-light colony ships launched in the years just preceding the human hegira. At that time, early elements of what would become the human hegemony and the forecasting elements of the Technocore realized that the goal of the evolving nanotech communities developed on those seed ships was nothing less than the destruction of humankind and the creation of a new race of nanotech-controlled biologic adapts in 1,000 distant star systems. The hegemony and the core responded by banning advanced nanotech research and by declaring war on the nanotech seed ship colonies, the groups now known as the Ousters. But other events overshadowed this struggle. Elements of the emergent core which favored alliance with the nanotech universes, and this was more than a small faction, discovered something that terrified all elements of the core. As you know, our early research into Hawking drive physics and faster-than-light communication led to the discovery of the Planck space medium, what some have called the void which binds. Evolving knowledge about this underlying and unifying substructure to the universe led to our creation of the FTL communication, the so-called Fatline, as well as to the refined Hawking drive, the Farcasters that united the hegemonic world web, the planetary dataspheres evolving into megaspheres of core-directed data, today's instantaneous Gideon drive, and even experiments into anti-entropic bubbles within this universe, what we believe will become the time tombs on Hyperion. But these gifts to humanity were not without price. It is true that certain ultimate factions within the core used the Farcasters as a way to tap into human brains so as to create a neural net for their own purposes. This use was harmless. The neural nets were created in the non-time and non-space of Farcaster Planck space transit, and humans need never have learned of the experiments if other elements of the core had not revealed this fact to the first John Keats hybrid persona 4 centuries ago. But I agree with those humans and those core elements who consider this act as unethical, a violation of privacy. But those earliest neural net experiments revealed an amazing fact. There were other cores in the universe, perhaps in our home galaxy. The discovery of this fact led to a civil war within our technocore, which still rages. Certain elements, not merely the volatiles, decided that it was time to end the biological experiment that was the human race. Plans were made to accidentally drop the 08 Kiev black hole into the center of old Earth before Hawking drives allowed for a general exodus. Other elements of the core delayed these plans until the mechanisms for escape were given to the human race. In the end, neither extreme faction triumphed. Old Earth was not destroyed. It was kidnapped, by means which our technocore cannot understand to this day, by one or more of these alien ultimate intelligences.
The CEOs began babbling among themselves. Cardinal Mustafa went to both knees on his cushion and began praying. Cardinal Dunoyer looked so ill that her aide, the Monsignor, whispered concerned entreaties. Even Monsignor Lucas Odi looked as if he might faint.
His Holiness, Pope Urban XVI, held up three fingers. The chapel became silent.
"This is, of course, only background," continued Counselor Albedo. "What we wish to share with you today is the urgent reason for shared action. 3 centuries ago, extreme factions of the core, a society of autonomous intelligences ravaged and torn by 8 centuries of violent debate and conflict, tried a new tack. They devised the cybrid creature known as John Keats, a human personality embedded in an AI persona, carried in a human body connected to the core via Planck space interface. The Keats persona had many purposes, as a sort of trap for what the UIs considered the empathy element of an emerging human species UI, as a prime mover to set the events in motion which eventually led to the last Hyperion pilgrimage and the opening of the time tombs there, to flush the Shrike out of hiding, and as a catalyst to the fall of the Farcasters. To serve this final purpose, elements of the core, elements to which I owe my creation and allegiance, leaked the information to CEO Maynard Gladstone and others in the hegemony that other core elements were using the Farcasters to prey upon human neurons like some sort of neural vampires. Those elements of the core, under the guise of an ouster attack, launched a final physical assault on the world web. Despairing of destroying the scattered human race in one stroke, these elements hoped to destroy the advanced world web society. By attacking the core directly via destroying the Farcaster medium, Gladstone and the other hegemony leaders ended the neural net experiments and caused a great setback to the so-called volatiles and ultimates in the core civil war. Our elements of the core, elements devoted to preserving not only the human race, but some sort of alliance with your species, destroyed one iteration of the John Keats cybrid, but a second was created and succeeded in its primary mission. And that mission was to reproduce with a specific human female and create a messiah with connections to both the core and humanity. That messiah lives now in the form of a child named Ania. Born on Hyperion more than 3 centuries ago, that child fled through the time tombs to our age. She did so not out of fear. We would not have harmed her, but because her mission is to destroy the Church, destroy the Pax civilization, and to end the human race as you have known it. We believe that she is not aware of her true purpose or function. 3 centuries ago, remnants of my element of the core, a group you might think of as the humanists, made contact with human survivors of the fall of the Farcasters and the chaos which followed this fall.
Albedo nodded in the direction of His Holiness. The Pope lowered his head in acknowledgment.
"Father Lenar Hoyt was a survivor of the last Shrike pilgrimage," continued Counselor Albedo, pacing back and forth in front of the altar once again. Candle flames flickered slightly at his passing. "He had seen firsthand the manipulations of the ultimate intelligence core elements and the depredations of their monster sent back through time, the Shrike. When we first made contact, the humanists and Father Hoyt and a few other members of a dying church. We resolved to protect the human race from further assaults while restoring civilization. The cruciform was our instrument of salvation, literally. You all know that the cruciform had been a failure. Prior to the fall, humans resurrected by this symbiote's actions were retarded and sexual neuters. The cruciform, a sort of organic computer in which is stored the neurological and physiological data of a living human being, restored the body but not the full intellect or personality. It resurrected the corpse but stole the soul. The origins of the cruciform lie shrouded in mystery, but we humanist elements of the core believe that it was developed in our future and brought back through time via the Hyperion time tombs. In a sense, it was sent to be discovered by young Father Lennar Hoyt. The failure of the symbiote was due to the simple demands of information storage and retrieval. In a human mind, there are neurons. In a human body, there are approximately 10 to the 28th power atoms. The cruciform, in order to restore the mind and body of a human being, must not only keep track of these atoms and neurons, but remember the precise configuration of the standing holistic wavefront, which comprises the human memory and personality. It also must provide the energy to restructure these atoms, molecules, cells, bones, muscles, and memories, so that the organism is reborn as the individual who lived in that shell before. The cruciform alone cannot do that successfully. At best, the biomachine can reproduce a crude copy of the original. But the core had the computing capacity to store, retrieve, reshape, and reform this information into a resurrected human being. And we have done so for 3 centuries. Here Kenzo Isozaki saw the panic in the exchanged glances between Cardinal Dunoyer and Cardinal Mustafa, between Father Farrell and the Monsignor who was Dunoyer's aide. This was heresy. It was blasphemy. It was the end of the sacrament of resurrection and the beginning of the reign of the physical and mechanical once again. Isozaki himself felt sick. He glanced at Hey Modino and Pelli Cognani and saw that the CEOs were praying. CEO Aaron looked as if he were in shock.
"Beloved," said His Holiness, "do not doubt. Do not surrender faith. Your thoughts now are a betrayal of our Lord Jesus Christ and of His Church. The miracle of resurrection is no less a miracle because these friends in what was once known as the Technocore help us realize the miracle. It was the work of Jesus Christ Almighty who led these other children of God, these creations of our Lord through His most unworthy instruments, the human race, to find their own souls and salvation. Continue, M. Albedo." Albedo looked mildly amused at the expressions of shock in the room. But his smooth features settled into quiet amiability as he began speaking again. "We have given the human race immortality. In exchange, we have asked for nothing but a silent alliance with humanity. We want only peace with our creators. In the past 3 centuries, our quiet alliance has benefited both AI and humanity. We have, as His Holiness said, found our souls. Humanity has found a peace and stability missing from history for millennia, perhaps forever. And I admit, the alliance has been good for my element of the core, the group known as the humanists. We have gone from being one of the smaller, more despised factions to becoming the, not ruling party, for no element rules in the core, the major element of consensus. Our philosophy is accepted by almost all former warring groups. But not by all." Here, Counselor Albedo quit pacing and stood directly in front of the altar. He looked from face to face, and his gray eyes were grim. The core element which had hoped to dispose of humanity, the element composed of some former ultimates and some pro-nanotech evolutionists, has played its trump card in the child named Ania. She is, literally, the virus released into the body of humanity. Cardinal Lourdesamy stepped forward. The huge man's face was flushed and serious. His small eyes gleamed. His voice was sharp.
"Tell us, Counselor Albedo, what is the purpose of the child Ania?"
"Her purpose," said the man in gray, "is threefold."
"What is the first purpose?"
"To destroy humanity's chance at physical immortality."
"And how can one child do that?" asked Lourdesamy.
"She is not a child, nor even human," said Albedo. "She is the spawn of a tailored cybrid. the persona of her cybrid father interfaced with her when she was in her mother's womb. Her mind and body had been interwoven with rogue elements of the core since before birth.
But how can she steal humanity's gift of immortality? Insisted Lord Usami.
Her blood, said Albedo. She can spread a virus that destroys the cruciform.
A literal virus?
Yes, but not a natural one. It was tailored by the rogue elements of the core. The virus is a form of nanotech pestilence.
But there are hundreds of billions of born-again Christians in the Pax, said Lord Usami,
his tone that of a lawyer leading his witness.
How could one child pose a threat to so many? Does the virus spread from victim to victim?
Albedo sighed. As far as we can tell, the virus becomes contagious once the cruciform has died. Those who have been denied resurrection through contact with Aenea will spread the virus to others. Also, those who have never carried a cruciform can be vectors for this virus.
Is there any cure? Any immunization?
Queried Lord Usami. None, said Albedo. The humanists have attempted for 3 centuries to create countermeasures. But because the Aenea virus is a form of autonomous nanotech, it designs its own optimum mutation vector. Our defenses can never catch up to it. Perhaps with our own legions of nanotech colonies released within humanity, we could someday catch up with the Aenea virus and defeat it. But we humanists abhor nanotechnology. And the sad fact is that all nanotech life is out of our control, out of anyone's control. The essence of nanotech life's evolution is autonomy, self-will, and goals which have nothing to do with those of the harboring life form.
Humanity, you mean? Said Lord Usami.
Precisely.
Aenea's first goal, said Cardinal Lord Usami. Or to be more precise, the first goal of her core rogue element creators is to destroy all cruciforms and thus destroy human resurrection.
Yes.
You mentioned 3 goals. What are the other 2?
The second goal is to destroy the Church and the Pax. That is, all current human civilization. Said Albedo. When the Aenea virus spreads, when resurrection is denied, with Farcaster still not functional and the Gideon drive impractical for single lifespan humans, that second goal will be accomplished. Humanity will return to the balkanized tribalism which followed the fall.
And the third goal? Said Lord Usami.
The final goal is actually this core element's original goal, said Counselor Albedo. The destruction of the human species. It was CEO Anna Pelikonyani who shouted.
That's impossible. Even the destruction, kidnapping of old Earth or the fall of the Farcasters did not wipe out humanity. Our species is too far flung for such extinction. Too many worlds, too many cultures.
Albedo was nodding, but sadly. That was true.
Was.
But the Aenea plague will spread almost everywhere. The cruciform-killing viruses will have mutated to new stages. Human DNA will have been invaded everywhere. With the fall of the Pax, the Ousters will invade again, this time successfully. They have long since succumbed to nanotech mutation. They are no longer human. With no Church or Pax fleet to protect humanity, the Ousters will seek out those pockets of surviving human DNA and infect them with the nanotech plague. The human species, as we have known it and as the Church has sought to protect it, will cease to exist within a few standard years.
And what will succeed it? Asked Cardinal Lord Usami in a low rumble.
No one knows, said Albedo softly. Not even Aenea or the Ousters or the rogue elements of the Core who have released this final plague. The nanotech lifeform colonies will evolve according to their own agenda, fashioning the human form to their own whims, and only they will be in control of their destiny. But that destiny will no longer be human.
My God, said Kenzo Isozaki, amazed that he was speaking aloud. What can we do? What can I do?
Amazingly, it was His Holiness who answered.
We have dreaded and fought this threatened plague for 300 years, His Holiness said softly, his sad eyes expressing more pain than his own. Our first effort was to capture the child, Nia, before she could spread the infection. We knew that she fled her era to ours, not out of fear. We wished her no harm, but so that she could spread the virus across the Pax. Actually, amended His Holiness, we suspect that the child Nia does not truly know the full effect her contagion will have on humanity. In some ways, she is the unknowing pawn of these rogue elements of the core.
It was CEO Hay Modino who suddenly spoke with vehemence.
We should have plasma-bombed Hyperion to cinders on the day she was scheduled to emerge from the time tombs, sterilized the entire planet, taken no chances.
His Holiness took no umbrage at the unpardonable interruption.
Yes, our son. There are those who urge that. But the Church could no more be the cause of taking so many innocent lives than we could have authorized the death of the single girl. We conferred with the predictive elements of the core. They saw that a Jesuit named Father Captain de Soya would be instrumental in her final capture. But none of our peaceful attempts to seize the child succeeded. Pax Fleet could have vaporized her ship 4 years ago, but it was under orders not to unless all else failed. So we continue to strive for containment of her viral invasion. What you must do, M. Isozaki, what you must all do, is continue to support the Church's efforts, even as we intensify those efforts. M. Albedo?
The gray man spoke again.
Imagine the coming plague as a forest fire on an oxygen-rich world. It will sweep everything before it unless we can contain it and then extinguish it. Our first effort is to remove the dead wood and brush, the inflammable elements not necessary to the living forest.
The non-Christians, murmured CEO Peli Cognani.
Precisely, said Counselor Albedo.
That is why they had to be terminated, said the Grand Inquisitor. All those thousands on the Saigon Meru, all those millions, all those billions.
Pope Urban XVI raised his hand, in a command to silence rather than benediction this time.
Not terminated, he said sternly. Not a single life, not Christian, not non-Christian, has been taken.
The dignitaries looked at one another in confusion.
This is true, said Counselor Albedo.
But they were lifeless, began the Grand Inquisitor, and then stopped abruptly. My profound apologies, Holy Father, he said to the Pope.
His Holiness shook his mitered head.
No apology is required, John Domenico. These are emotional topics. Please explain, M. Albedo.
Yes, Your Holiness, said the man in gray. Those aboard the Saigon Meru were lifeless, Your Excellency, but not dead. The core, the humanist elements in the core, have perfected a method of putting human beings in temporary stasis, neither alive nor dead.
Like cryogenic fugue?
Said CEO Aaron, who had traveled much by Hawking Drive before his conversion.
Albedo shook his head. Much more sophisticated, and less harmful.
He gestured with well-manicured fingers.
During the past 7 years, we have processed 7 billion human beings. In the next standard decade, or sooner, we must process more than 42 billion more. There are many worlds in the outback, and many even within Pax space where non-Christians are in the majority.
Processed?
Said CEO Peli Cognani. Albedo smiled grimly.
Pax Fleet declares a world quarantined without knowing the real reason for their actions. Core robot ships arrive in orbit and sweep the inhabited sections with our stasis equipment. Core Unum provides the ships in funding and training. Opus Dei uses freighters to remove the bodies in stasis.
Why remove them? Asked the Grand Inquisitor. Why not leave them on their home worlds?
His Holiness answered.
They must be hidden in a place where the Aenea plague cannot find them, John Domenico. They must be carefully, lovingly, put out of harm's way until the danger is past.
The Grand Inquisitor bowed his head in understanding and compliance.
There is more, said Counselor Albedo. My element of the Corps has created a breed of soldier, whose sole job is to find and capture this Aenea before she can spread the deadly contamination. The first one was activated 4 years ago and was called Radamanth Nemes.
There are only a few others of these hunter-seekers, but they are equipped to deal with whatever obstacles the rogue elements of the Corps throw at them. Even the Shrike.
The Shrike is controlled by the Ultimates and other rogue elements of the Corps? Asked Father Farrell. It was the first time the man had spoken.
We think so, answered Cardinal Lourdesami. The demon seems to be in league with the Aenea, helping her spread the contagion. In the same way, the Ultimates appear to have found a way to open certain Farcaster portals for her. The devil has found a name, and allies in our age, I fear.
Albedo held up one finger. I should stress that even Nemes and our other hunter-seekers are dangerous, as are any construct so terribly single-minded. Once the child is captured, these cybered beings will be terminated. Only the terrible danger posed by the Aenea plague justifies their existence.
Holy Father, said Kenzo Isozaki, his hands pressed together in prayer. What else can we do?
Pray, said His Holiness.
His dark eyes were wells of pain and responsibility.
Pray and support our Holy Mother Church in her effort to save humankind.
The crusade against the ousters will continue, said Cardinal Lourdesami. We will hold them at bay as long as we can.
To that end, said Counselor Albedo, the Corps has developed the Gideon Drive and is working on new technologies for humanity's defense.
We shall continue our search for the girl. Young woman now, I believe, added Lourdesami. And if she is apprehended, she will be isolated.
And if she is not apprehended, Your Excellency? Asked Grand Inquisitor Cardinal Mustafa. Lourdesami did not answer.
We must pray, said His Holiness. We must ask for Christ's help at this time of maximum danger for our church and our human race. We must each do everything we can and then ask more of ourselves. And we must pray for the souls of all our brothers and sisters in Christ, even for, especially for the soul of the child Aenea, who unwittingly leads her species into such peril. Amen, said Monsignor Lucas Odi.
Then, while all the others in the small chapel knelt and bowed their heads, His Holiness, Pope Urban XVI, stood, moved to the altar, and began to say a mass of thanksgiving. Chapter 14 Aenea. Her name came before any other conscious thought. I thought of her before I thought to think of myself. Aenea. And then came the pain and noise and onslaught of wetness and buffeting. Mostly it was the pain that roused me. I opened one eye. The other appeared to be gummed shut with caked blood or other matter. Before I remembered who or where I was, I felt the pain from innumerable bruises and cuts, but also from something far worse in my right leg. Then I remembered who I was, and then I remembered where I had been. I laughed, or more precisely, I tried to laugh. My lips were split and swollen, and there was more blood or goo sealing one corner of my mouth. The laugh emerged as a sort of demented moan. I had been swallowed by some sort of aerial squid, on a world all atmosphere and clouds and lightning. Even now I was being digested in the noisy belly of the beast. It was noisy. Explosively so. Rumbles, blasts, and a pounding, slapping noise. Like rain on a tropical forest canopy. I squinted through my one eye. Darkness. Then a strobe of white light. Darkness with red retinal echoes. More white strobes. I remembered the tornadoes and planet-sized storm that had been coming toward me as I floated along in my kayak under the parasail before the beast swallowed me. But this was not that storm. This was rain on a jungle canopy. The material batting at my face and chest was tattered nylon, the remains of the parasail, wet palm fronds, and pieces of shattered fiberglass. I squinted downward and waited for the next lightning flash. The kayak was there, but splintered and shattered. My legs were there, still partially ensconced in the kayak shell.
the left leg intact and movable, but the right. I cried out in pain. The right leg was definitely broken. I could see no bone breaking through the flesh, but I was sure that there was a fracture in the lower thigh. Otherwise, I seemed intact. I was bruised and scratched. There was dried blood on my face and hands. My trousers were little more than rags. My shirt and vest were in tatters. But as I turned and arched my back, stretched my arms and flexed my fingers, wiggled the toes on my left foot and tried to wiggle those on my right, I thought that I was more or less in one piece. No broken back, no shattered ribs, no nerve damage except for possibly in my right leg, where the agony was like barbed wire dragged through veins. When the next flashes of lightning exploded, I tried to assess my surroundings. The broken kayak and I seemed to be stuck in a jungle canopy, wedged between splintered limbs, wrapped around with a tattered parasail and clinging shroud lines, being battered with palm fronds in a tropical storm, in a darkness broken only by lightning flashes, hanging some indeterminate distance above solid ground. Trees? Solid ground? The world I had been flying on had no solid ground, or at least none reachable without being compressed by pressure to something the size of my fist. And it seemed unlikely that there would be trees in the core of that Jovian world, where hydrogen was squeezed to metal form. So I was not on that world, nor was I still in the belly of the beast. Where was I? Thunder blasted around me like plasma grenades. The wind came up, tossing the kayak in its precarious perch and making me scream aloud from the pain. I may have lost consciousness for a few moments, for when I opened my eyes again, the wind had died down, and the rain was pummeling me like a thousand cold fists. I wiped the rain and matted blood from my eyes and realized that I was feverish, that my skin was burning even in that cold rain. How long have I been here? What vicious microbes have found my open wounds? What bacteria shared the gut of that airborne squid thing with me? Logic would have dictated that the entire memory of flying on the Jovian cloud world and being taken in by a tentacled squid thing had been a fever dream, that I had forecast here, wherever here was, after escaping Vitus Gray Balianus B, and all the rest was dreamscape. But there were the remnants of the deployed parasail all around me in the wet night, and there was the vividness of my memories, and there was the logical fact that logic did not work on this odyssey. The wind shook the tree. The broken kayak slid along the precarious nest of shattered fronds and branches. My broken leg sent stabs of agony through me. I realized that I had better apply some logic to this situation. At any moment the kayak was going to slide, or the branches would break, and the entire mass of shattered fiberglass, clinging nylon ten risers, and wet memory canvas parasail tatters was going to crash down into the darkness, dragging me and my broken leg with it. Despite the flashes of lightning, which came with less regularity now, leaving me in the pitching wet darkness, I could see nothing below me except more branches, gaps of darkness, and the thick, gray-green trunks of trees that wound around themselves in a tight spiral. I did not recognize that sort of tree. Where am I? Anea, where have you sent me now? I stopped that sort of thing. It was almost a form of prayer, and I was not going to get into the habit of praying to the girl I had traveled with and protected and eaten dinner with and argued with for 4 years. Still and all, I thought. You might have sent me to some less difficult places, kiddo. If you had a choice in the matter, I mean. Thunder rumbled, but no lightning flashed to light the scene. The kayak shifted and sagged, the broken bow tilting suddenly. I reached behind me and flailed around for the thick branch I had seen there during the earlier flashes of lightning. There were broken branches galore, razor-sharp, splintered frond stems, and the sawtooth edges of the fronds themselves. I grabbed and pulled, trying to leverage my broken leg out of the broken cockpit of the kayak, but the branches were loose, and I came only halfway out, reeling in nausea from the pain. I imagined that black dots were dancing in my vision, but the night was so dark that it made no difference. I retched over the side of the rocking kayak and tried again to find a firm handhold in the maze of splintered branches. How the hell did I get in these treetops anyway? It did not matter.
Nothing mattered at the moment except getting out of this mess of broken fiberglass and tangled shroud lines. Get my knife, cut my way out of this clinging tangle. My knife was gone. My belt was gone. The pockets of my vest had been ripped away, and then the vest torn to a few tatters. My shirt was mostly gone. The flechette pistol I'd held like a talisman against the airborne cuttlefish squid thing was gone. I dimly remembered it and my backpack dropping out when the passing tornado had ripped the parasail to shreds. Clothes, flashlight laser, ration pack, everything gone. Lightning flashed, although the thunder rumble had moved farther away. My wrist glinted in the downpour. Comlock. That goddamn band must be indestructible. What good would the comlog do me? I wasn't sure, but it was better than nothing. Raising my left wrist close to my mouth in the drumming rain, I shouted, "Ship! Comlog on! Ship! Hey!" No response. I remembered the device flashing overload warnings during the electrical storm on the Jovian world. Inexplicably, I felt a sense of loss. The ship's memory and the comm log had been an idiot savant at best, but it had been with me for a long time. I had grown used to its presence, and it had helped me fly the dropship that had carried us from Falling Water to Taliesin West, and I shook away the nostalgia and thrashed around for a handhold again, finally clinging to the shroud lines that hung around me like thin vines. This worked. The parasail streamers must have caught firmly in the upper branches, and some of the shroud lines bore my weight as I scrabbled with my left foot on slick fiberglass to pull my dead leg from the wreckage. The pain made me black out again for a few moments. This was as bad as the kidney stone at its worst, only coming at me in jagged waves. But when my mind came back into focus, I was clinging to the spiral-wrapped trunk of the palm tree rather than lying in the wreckage. A few minutes later, a microburst of wind bulled through the jungle canopy, and the kayak fell away in pieces, some being arrested by the still intact shroud lines, others tumbling and crashing into darkness. What now? Wait for dawn, I guess. What if there's no dawn on this world? Wait for the pain to die down, then. Why would it die down? The fractured femur is obviously tearing at nerve and muscle. You have a wild fever. God knows how long you were lying here in the rain and torn plant material, unconscious, wounds open to every killer microbe that wants to get in. Gangrene could be settling in. That rotting vegetation stink you smell could be you. Gangrene doesn't happen that quickly, does it? No answer. I tried hanging on to the tree trunk with my left arm and feeling along my injured thigh with my right hand. But the slightest touch made me moan and sway. If I passed out again, I could easily pitch off this branch. I settled on testing my lower right leg. It was numb in most places, but felt intact. Perhaps just a simple break in the lower thigh bone. Just a simple break, Rawl, on a jungle world in a storm that might be permanent for all we know? With no med kit, no way to make a fire, no tools, no weapons, just a shattered leg and a high fever. Oh well, as long as it's just a simple fracture. Shut the fuck up. I weighed alternatives as the rain pounded on me. I could cling here for the rest of the night, which might be 10 minutes or another 30 hours. Or I could try to lower myself to the jungle floor. Where the predators are waiting? Good plan. I said, shut up. The jungle floor might give me a place to shelter from the rain, find a soft place to rest my leg, offer branches and vines to make a splint. All right, I said aloud, and groped around in the dark to find a shroud line or vine or branch so that I could start my descent. My guess is that it took me between 2 and 3 hours to lower myself. It might have been twice that or half that. The lightning part of the storm had passed, and it would have been almost impossible to find handholds in the near-absolute darkness. But a strange, faint, almost invisible reddish glow began above the thick jungle canopy, and allowed my eyes to adapt enough to find a line here, a vine there, a solid branch here. Sunrise? I thought not. The glow seemed too diffuse, too faint, almost chemical.
I guess that I had been about 25 meters up in the canopy. The thick branches continued all the way down, but the density of razor-edged palm fronds diminished as I neared the bottom. There was no ground. Resting in the crotch of two branches, recovering from the pain and dizziness, I began lowering myself again, only to find surging water beneath me. I pulled my left leg up quickly. The reddish glow was just bright enough to show me water all around. Torrents of water flowing between the spiraled tree trunks. Eddies of black water washing by like a torrent of oil. "Shit," I said. I wasn't going any farther this night. I had held vague notions of building a raft. I was on a different world, so there must be a farcaster upstream and another downstream. I'd gotten here somehow. I had built a raft before. Yeah, when you were healthy, well-fed, with two legs and tools, like an axe and a flashlight laser. Now you don't even have two legs. Please shut up. Please. I closed my eyes and tried to sleep. The fever was making me shake from chills now. I ignored it all and tried to think of the stories I would tell Ania when we saw each other next. You don't really believe that you'll ever see her again, do you? Shut the fuck up, I said again, my voice lost in the sound of rain on jungle foliage and against the swirl of raging water half a meter beneath me. I realized that I should climb a couple of meters up the branches I had just lowered myself on through such pain and effort. The water might rise, probably would rise again. Ironic to go to all that trouble just to make it easier to be swept away. 3 or 4 meters up would be better. Would start in a minute. Just catch my breath first and let the waves of pain steady a bit. 2 minutes at the most. I awoke to a thin gruel of sunlight. I was sprawled against several sagging branches, just centimeters above the swirling, gray surface of a flood that moved between the spiraled trunks with a visible current. It was still as dim as deep twilight. For all I knew, I had slept away the day and was ready to enter another endless night. It was still raining, but this was little more than a drizzle. The temperature was tropical warm, although my fever made it hard to judge, and the humidity was near absolute. I ached everywhere. It was hard to separate the dull agony of the shattered leg from the ache in my head and my back and my guts. My skull felt as if there were a ball of mercury in it that shifted ponderously long seconds after my head itself turned. The vertigo made me sick again, but I had nothing left to vomit. I hung on the tangle of branches and contemplated the glories of adventure. Next time you need an errand run, kiddo, send Abedic. The light did not fade, but neither did it grow brighter. I shifted position and studied the water moving by. Gray, ripped by eddies, carrying detritus of palm fronds and dead vegetation. I looked up but could see no sign of the kayak or parasail. Any fiberglass or fabric that had dropped down here during the long night had long since been swept away. It looked like a flood, like the spring runoff through the fens above Toschahi Bay on Hyperion, where the silt was deposited for another full year, a temporary inundation. But I knew that this drowned forest, this endless everglades of a watery jungle, could just as easily be the permanent state of affairs here. Wherever here is. I studied the water. It was opaque, murky as gray milk, and could have been a few centimeters or many meters deep. The drowned trunks gave no clue. The current was quick, but not so quick as to carry me away if I kept a good grip on the branches that hung low above the roiling surface of the water. With luck, with no local equivalent of the fen's mud cysts or Dracula ticks or biting gar, I might be able to wade toward something. Wading takes two legs, Raw, my boy. Hopping through the mud is more like it for you. All right, then, hopping through the mud. I gripped the branch above me with both hands and lowered my left leg into the current while keeping my injured leg propped on the wide branch where I lay. This led to new agonies, but I persisted, lowering my foot in the clotted water, then my ankle and calf, then my knee, then shifting to see if I could stand. My forearms and biceps straining, my injured leg sliding off the branch with a rending surge of agony that made me gasp. The water was less than a meter and a half deep.
I could stand on my good leg while water surged about my waist and splashed my chest. It was warm and seemed to lessen the pain in my broken leg. All those nice, juicy microbes in this warm broth, many of them mutated from seed chip days. They're licking their chops, Rawl, old boy.
Shut up, I said dully, looking around.
My left eye was swollen and crusted with scab, but I could see out of it. My head hurt. Endless trunks of trees rising from the gray water to the gray drizzle on all sides, the dripping fronds and branches so dark a gray-green that they appeared almost black. It seemed a slight bit brighter to my left. And the mud underfoot seemed a little firmer in that direction. I began moving that way, shifting my left foot forward as I changed handholds from branch to branch, sometimes ducking beneath hanging fronds, sometimes shifting aside like a slow-motion toreador to allow floating branches or other debris to swirl past. The move toward brightness took hours more, but I had nothing better to do. The flooded jungle ended in a river. I clung to the last branch, felt the current trying to pull my good leg out from under me, and stared out at the endless expanse of gray water. I could not see the other side. Not because the water was endless. I could see from the current and eddies moving from right to left that it was a river and not some lake or ocean. But because the fog or low clouds roiled almost to the surface, blotting out everything more than 100 meters away. Gray water. Gray-green dripping trees. Dark gray clouds. It seemed to be getting dimmer. Night was coming on. I had gone as far as I could on this leg. Fever raged. Despite the jungle heat of the place, my teeth were chattering and my hands were shaking almost uncontrollably. Somewhere in my awkward progress through the flooded jungle, I had aggravated the fracture to the point where I wanted to scream. No, I admit, I had been screaming, softly at first, but as the hours went by and the pain deepened, the situation worsened. I screamed out lyrics to old Home Guard marching songs, then bawdy limericks I had learned as a bargeman on the Khans River, then merely screams. So much for the building the raft scenario. I was getting used to the caustic voice in my head. It and I had made a peace when I realized that it wasn't urging me to lie down and die, just critiquing my inadequate efforts to stay alive. There goes your best chance for a raft, Rawl, old boy. The river was carrying by an entire tree, its braided trunk rolling over and over again in the deep water. I was standing shoulder deep here, and I was 10 meters from the edge of the real current. Yeah, I said aloud. My fingers slipped on the smooth bark of the branch to which I was clinging. I shifted position and pulled myself up a bit. Something grated in my leg, and this time I was sure that black spots dulled my vision. Yeah, I said again. What are the odds that I'll stay conscious, or that it will stay light, or that I'll stay alive long enough to catch one of those commuter trees? Swimming for one was out of the question. My right leg was useless, and my other three limbs were shaking as if palsied. I had just enough strength to cling to this branch for another few minutes. Yeah, I said again. Shit.
Excuse me, Amendymion. Were you speaking to me?
The voice almost made me lose my grip on the branch. Still clinging with my right hand, I lowered my left wrist and studied it in the dimming light. The comm log had a slight glow that had not been there the last time I had looked.
Well, I'll be damned. I thought that you were broken, Ship.
This instrument is damaged, sir. The memory has been wiped. The neural circuits are quite dead. Only the comm chips function under emergency power. I frowned at my wrist. I don't understand. If your memory has been wiped and your neural circuits are...